ACT Radio is taped and produced at the KTEP studios at the University of Texas at El Paso. The views and opinions expressed on ACT Radio are solely those of its participants and do not necessarily reflect those of KTEP, its staff, or management.
Welcome to ACT Radio, Animal Concerns of Texas. I'm Greg Lawson.
And I'm Tom Linney.
Here on ACT, we talk about how we humans relate to other animals.
We talk about how we use them for food, clothing, and entertainment, and how there are humane alternatives to these practices.
We also talk about how a plant-based diet is the best thing you can do for the environment.
So if you're concerned about the environment, if you're concerned about the way animals are treated, if you're concerned about your health, stay with us for Animal Concerns of Texas.
Coming up on today's show, we feature a conversation with Carolyn Mullen and Abby Rogers of the National Museum of Animals and Society. That's coming up a little later on the show, but first some news.
The Animal Legal Defense Fund filed a petition with the U.S. Department of Agriculture, or USDA, and the USDA's Food and Safety and Inspection Service to clarify dangerously confusing labeling and the use of antibiotics in meat and poultry. The rampant abuse of antibiotics that plagues factory farms poses a disastrous threat to human health and safety and to the well-being of animals by creating antibiotic-resistant superbugs, among other complications. Yet the agriculture industry is not required to disclose its use of antibiotics to consumers. People rely on the USDA to protect them by regulating the use of dangerous drugs. Labeling is the main way shoppers understand what they are purchasing and feeding to their families. Producers who fail to disclose the truth about their products are harming consumers. Information about food safety and production methods is crucial to the ability to make informed choices, and the USDA has a duty to empower citizens with this knowledge, especially in the face of one of the largest public health threats of our time. Animals also need the USDA to act on ALDF's petition immediately. Factory farms inherently rely on mass administration of antibiotics. The intensive confinement central to industrial agriculture weakens the immune systems of factory-farmed animals by causing immense physiological stress. Instead of addressing these terrible conditions, factory farms turn to subtherapeutic or non-illness-related doses of antibiotics as a quick fix. This abuse promotes rapid animal growth, less feeding of animals, and saves producers money. But the animals continue to suffer the horrors of intense confinement, unsanitary conditions, rapid hormonal growth, and reduction in feed. In the end, misusing antibiotics is a win for agribusiness, but a loss for animals and for consumers. Millions of animals are being harmed and consumers misled by this failure to accurately label food products, and this is a matter critical to public and animal health. Please visit ALDF.org for details on how to take action.
A study recently published by the Zoological Society of London shows that six chimpanzees who were given a game which involved moving red dice or Brazil nuts through a maze of pipes enjoyed solving the puzzle, whether they got the reward or not. Chimps, which are our closest relatives in the animal kingdom, seem to get the same level of satisfaction out of solving brain teasers as their human cousins. Most problem-solving behaviors which are witnessed in the animal kingdom, where animals use tools or navigate mazes, are usually with the aim of reaching food. Chimpanzees have been witnessed in the wild using tools such as a stick to forage for insects or honey in hard-to-reach places like tree stumps. Faye Clark, a researcher for the Zoological Society of London, said that their research showed that chimps could be motivated by more than just food. She said, "We noticed that the chimps were keen to complete the puzzle, regardless of whether or not they received a food reward." The six adult chimps, two females and one male, took part in the challenge every day voluntarily. They were not trained on how to use the device. They had to move red dice or nuts through a network of pipes by prodding sticks through holes until they fell out into a container. The researchers said that their behavior suggests that they get similar feelings of satisfaction to humans who often complete brain games for a feel-good reward. Stay with us. Coming up next, we feature a conversation with Carolyn Marino Mullen, who's the founder and executive director of the National Museum of Animals and Society, and with Abby Rogers, who's a curator with the National Museum of Animals and Society. That's next on ACT Radio. Joining us now on ACT Radio, Carolyn Marino Mullen and Abby Rogers. Thanks for being with us on the show today, guys.
Thank you.
Well, maybe we'll start out with each of you telling our listeners how you became involved in animal issues, starting with you, Carolyn.
Oh, boy. Well, I think that's a big question. Well, I guess my big intro into animal protection was really the Yes on 10 campaign in Florida with the Gestation Crate Initiative. So I was in high school at the time just gathering signatures, and over a couple of years' time, I collected about 8,000. So that was really and I was organizing the county in Miami, and then later when I went to college in Gainesville. So that was my introduction. I've never left. And I worked with Farm Sanctuary and left Farm Sanctuary to start this museum.
And you, Abby?
I don't know. I've loved animals since I was a little kid. First got involved in my local shelter as when I was, 12 or so. Went vegan at the age of 14, and
wow.
Always wanted to be involved with particularly farm animals. And it wasn't until I was in college that I took an internship with a farm animal sanctuary, and ended up, after I graduated, becoming the animal care director there for about 3 years or so. So I was responsible for the health care of about 200 animals, ranging from horses to rabbits and chickens.
Which farm sanctuary was this, Abby?
It's the Catskill Animal Sanctuary,
located
in Socrates, New York.
Mm-hmm.
That was an amazing experience, and was really where I first got to know a lot of these species on an individual level, these animals on an individual level. And so it's been really fun to be able to bring that into this chicken exhibit.
So tell us about this new museum. How did this get started?
Sure. Well, this is Carolyn speaking. And, I started it back in, the planning stages were dating back to 2009, basically. I was running the education department at Farm Sanctuary and doing spring cleaning, and I came across this old newsletter with Gene Bauer, who's the founder of the organization, and he has this amazing mullet, in the picture. And I'm like, this is just awesome, and I was faced with this, deliberation, do I toss this, because space is precious in the office, or do I keep this? And, it started getting me thinking, what other materials from our movement have just been tossed out? The information in our movement gets outdated pretty quickly, right? The number of animals that get killed or exploited change dramatically from year to year. And so it just got me wondering. And then, I started thinking about our movement as a social movement in the larger scheme of American history. And do we have representation in a museum anywhere? And I started doing some poking around, and sure, civil rights is recognized in the museum world, or women's suffrage, civil rights, even the labor movement, all have representation in the museum sector, whether it's in the Smithsonian or they have their own institutions. But when it came to animal protection, there just wasn't anything. And, to me, that just broke my heart, because I know how hard all of us fight for animals and their protection. So that's kind of how it all began. And, I had worked in some museums prior to starting NMAS, but I really got my foot running after I left Farm Sanctuary, and I've worked in a number of museums since to kind of get more firsthand experience.
How long has the museum been in operation?
We organized in 2010, going on three and a half years.
Of course, your new exhibit about chickens, Uncooped, is focused on the chickens, but what other animals are represented by your museum?
Yeah, well, you know, it's a big subject matter, animal protection. I mean, imagine how many animals on all different fronts we're advocating for within this movement. I mean, not just dogs and cats, but coyotes and bears, and we're talking on a global scale. So it is a massive, massive undertaking what we're doing. And our movement to protect animals isn't recent. You know, it dates centuries, if millennia. I mean, we go back to Socrates and Pythagoras, who were speaking out for animal welfare. So our collection, thanks to Abby, has grown incredibly. We're over at 3,000 pieces of historically significant material. Abby, in addition to curating the chicken exhibit, is also our collections manager. So we've been going piecemeal, I guess, in terms of acquiring more pieces of material, and we're going exhibit by exhibit. So we have an incredible resource in terms of humane education materials. A lot of folks don't know that the author Jack London had a humane youth group, you know, the author of White Fang.
Oh, wow. So
to have, yeah, and he was strongly against animals and entertainment. And so the kids that were involved in his group really protested and rised up against Ringling Brothers for their use of animals. And what my research has discovered is that Ringling Brothers stopped using animals for 4 years because of their efforts.
What? Really?
Yes.
I wasn't aware of that.
Yeah, so this is the incredible history that us as animal activists don't even know, and we should be so proud that we have a long legacy of caring individuals and some pretty incredible victories as well. So we've been slowly, you know, acquiring our collection, and we've put out a grassroots call for artifacts while we're looking also, you know, at the formalized structure of animal protection and getting materials from Farm Sanctuary, for instance, or that Lauren Arnellis with the Food Empowerment Project, she donated some pieces to us. We're also looking for just the homegrown efforts, you know, in these small little towns all across, you know, America that are working for animals.
You'll be willing to accept a picture of Greg with a mullet from many years ago as well?
Totally, totally. Wouldn't it be great, you know, fashion of the animal world or something?
Let's talk about chickens a little bit. People don't realize, and I didn't when I was a vegetarian for many years, that the chickens probably face the worst conditions of any animals on farms. Their lives are incredibly painful to contemplate on factory farms. And so many people think that free-range chickens is the answer, and I don't think so. I think, you know, not eating eggs is the kindest thing we can do for the birds.
You know, I think maybe we should look at the history. I mean, you know, in your research, you know, what is it that has allowed us over time as a society to really move from viewing chickens as animals to chickens as food? I saw a video on your website that it was interviewing people and it said, well, what do you think of when you hear the word chicken? And it was really, you know, food, eggs, KFC. And, you know, what's caused that now? I mean, we're really so far from what our perception of animals were even 20, 30 years ago.
Yeah, this is Abby. And I think what you're saying is absolutely true. Chickens are not only, I think, some of the most abused animals in our culture, but some of the most underappreciated. I think it's something where so many of us don't have exposure to chickens, and so many people think of, as you said, like in this, we did these interviews, and you ask people, what do you think of when you hear the word chicken? And they don't think of an animal first. They think of a food item first. And, you know, I think definitely the rise of more concentrated, confined, industrialized animal production has definitely contributed to that, the fact that we don't see the chickens. They're indoors, and they are intentionally hidden from public view is definitely part of that. And the other thing is we have a whole section in this exhibit on our perception of chickens and how chickens are so, even though they're hidden from our public view as individuals, we do see them, we talk, you know, in our language, we talk about somebody being cocky or someone being a mother hen or somebody flew the coop. You know, there are so many different terms. We found this huge a number of artifacts as well as modern images that compare women with chickens, you know, from everything from the term chick, meaning a woman. We have an interview on there with Carol J. Adams about how we sexualize images of chickens, and then also talk about what our language talking about women makes them consumable in a way talking about chickens. There's also a section in there about images that we term suicide food, which is images of animals where they're acting like they want to be eaten. You know, the chicken advertising the barbecue joint with his thumbs up and an apron on. And I think a lot of these, we view chickens as stupid. We view chickens as...
bird-brained.
Exactly. And it makes it so that we don't... I think it makes it very convenient where we don't have to worry about eating them because they're dumb, and they end on top of that, they want to be eaten.
Right. It seems, you know, when you want to be able to exploit something as an object, you try to disenfranchise it. And I saw in the images that are just really laughable, you talked about Carol Adams' book and her book and the sexual politics of meat. And it's really just hilarious that they take chickens, and there's these images of, you know, chickens in high heels and, you know, in very provocative poses. I mean, it's really just amazing that, you know, that people would have gone for that. You know, I feel like we're so much more evolved today, but you still see it in campaigns today.
Absolutely. You would think that this would be a thing of the past, but a lot of these images are from the modern day, and I still see the chicken advertising a barbecue joint today.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's all pervasive in our society, and it's quite strange, very strange.
Yeah, I don't know how it doesn't freak people out.
And I guess we have to look too at how we view chickens when we're children. You know, if we're not seeing them because there's no farm nearby where, you know, kids are reading about them in kids' books. And it seems like really your exposure to chickens as a kid is them living happily on some farm, you know, that just really doesn't represent the way chickens are raised today.
Absolutely. And we do have a section in the exhibit too, where we have some different children's books and games, and a lot of the games, like there's an image on the site of an artifact that we have that's a mother hen target practice thing, game where you
throw darts. Yeah.
At this hen, this image of a hen, to make her lay an egg. Wow. But then, you know, we have come to recent chickens in film and television, and then we have, like, the film Chicken Run that came out, I think, in 2000.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And even the 2005 animated Chicken Little movie are starting to view chickens as the heroic underdog, which I think is an interesting other side of it, where... you know, they are kind of the ultimate underdog, but it's neat to start to see some places where they are the hero.
I think Chicken Run, the movie, did a lot for our movement, and that's really strange to say for a cartoon like that. But I've talked to people who said, you know, that changed their mind about chickens. And I'd like to throw in a couple of really strange things. I remember when I was a child, they had, like, sideshows where chickens would dance, and the way they got them to dance was the grid they were standing on was electrified. Mm-hmm. And the other image I have of chickens from my youth, one of my earliest memories is of my grandmother twisting the head off of a chicken. Before she cooked it for dinner. I think things like that are, you know, stepping stones to the path I've found myself on. Why can't I forget the chicken without a head running around the backyard, you know? Today, when you can buy a bucket of crispy-coated chicken and not even think of the animal while you're eating it, there's a disconnect.
And, you know, in your research, what did you learn about chickens that, you know, that surprised you? It seems like there's really a, you know, complicated social component to chickens, and also just the way they interact with each other is supposed to be quite intricate.
Absolutely. They are fascinating animals, in my opinion. And they are, you know, for all this, you know, these concepts that we have of them as being bird brains or stupid, we have several animal behaviorists interviewed in the exhibit who have all done work, and there are a number of others who have done studies showing that chicks, newly hatched chicks, have the ability to do basic math.
Wow.
They understand geometry. They understand some basic elements of physics and things that a human infant can't figure out. Now, of course, in my opinion, talk of intelligence is, you just can't compare the intelligence of different species. It's different, and each species is going to have the intelligence that helps them survive.
Right.
Yeah. So a newly hatched chick that is immediately going to be able to run around and follow its mother and learn how to find food is going to need to be able to identify that, okay, if this is an image of a hen, you see an image of a hen, and then you see an image of a hen behind a tree where you can just see her head and her tail, a human infant would not consider that to be the same. They would consider that to be a head and a tail and a tree. Whereas a newly hatched chick can say, oh, that's still my mom,
uh-huh.
Which for a human infant that's just going to lie in a crib doesn't need to know that. Whereas the chick needs to be able to follow its mother. And, yeah, they have complex societies with, you know, where they can recognize other individuals,
mm-hmm.
number of individuals over time, keep track of the behavior of different individuals. A hen will be able to say, that rooster provides good, you know, food, so I will be willing to mate with him. Or that rooster tends to trick me about finding food.
Uh-huh.
You know, roosters will call hens to food, and sometimes they will pretend they found food because they want the hens to come over. And sometimes it works, but they do it too often, and hen will say, forget it. So it's some complex, you know, understanding of keeping track of past events, looking forward to the future, these things that people often say that chickens can't do.
And looking at your website, I noticed that you all help support humane education. And along those lines of education and chickens, I was reading some stories about how schools handle chickens with different projects in terms of incubators and raising them as a project and then turning them over for food. What are some of the stories that you all came across?
There are so many different ways that we treat chickens. And, you know, we have a section on that, but it's, you know, we ended up having to have a little disclaimer at the end like, this is not all of them. There are so many different ways. And I would venture to say, and for some of these things, it's because we do kind of see them as disposable. But I don't think you'd have a classroom project with puppies or something. But anyway, it ranges from the big egg and meat industries to, as you mentioned earlier, free-range operations, people, the backyard chicken movement, but including the classroom hatching projects. We have a couple great stories under that section, one by a classroom teacher and humane educator who also worked at the Catskill Animal Sanctuary with me, and the story of a rooster named Middlechild who lives at the sanctuary and who was a reject from a classroom hatching project. You know, so often once the chicks are hatched, a lot of times they're hatched with deformities because either people leave on the weekends when they hatch or people aren't able to control the environment of the eggs the way that a mother hen would. But then once the chicks are hatched, like, what do you do with them? So some go to farms and are eventually slaughtered. Some are just left in a box somewhere or thrown in a dumpster. But Middlechild was from a hatching project, and he eventually became an ambassador for humane education. He went to classrooms with Betsy, the teacher I mentioned, took him to classrooms, and he interacted with kids, and kind of taught them some respect for chickens, which I think is a really cool kind of full circle type thing. We also have a story about a teenage girl named Whitney Hillman, who, this is a little different from the traditional hatching project, but she, her high school had an animal production class where they would raise the chicks to the point of slaughtering them. The high school students were supposed to slaughter the chickens they had raised.
Wow.
And Whitney said, "I don't think so," and the school would not let her back out of it, so she ended up actually sneaking in and stealing her chick, and then leaving this note for the school saying, you know, this is what I've done, and this is why I've done it. And she offered to pay, you know, whatever, take whatever punishment, but she said, "I'm not going to tell you where this chick is."
So
you need to see somebody kind of standing up for the chicken that she, you know, came to see as a loved one.
Well, sure. After you establish a relationship with another species, it's hard to see them as anything else but a being deserving rights and respect. So tell us where our listeners can go to see the exhibit about the chickens online.
So you can find the exhibit either through the museum website, which is museumofanimals.org, or you can go directly to the exhibit site, which is just uncooped.org.
We've been talking with Carolyn Marino-Mullen and Abby Rogers of the National Museum of Animals and Society. We appreciate you being with us on the show, and best of luck in future endeavors.
Thanks for having us.
If you'd like to learn more about a plant-based diet, please visit the Vegetarian Society of El Paso's website at vsep.org.
And if you'd like to listen to some of the past shows of ACT Radio, you can find them at ktep.org. Just click on the Listen button.
Until next time, I'm Greg Lawson.
And I'm Tom Linney. For the animals, the earth, and a healthier humanity, thanks for listening to Animal Concerns of Texas.
Chicken, where you been? Down on the farm, check on my hen. Super chicken, super chicken, have you heard? The Wyandotte Rooster got a brand new.